Had Mary Queen of Scots, Philip II, and the Pope succeeded in their designs upon England, the course of English political and religious history would have been very different. But short of a full-scale Spanish invasion and counter-reformation, most of the events we've described so far would have had very little effect on the day-to-day lives of ordinary English men and women. To illustrate the point, I'd like you to imagine such a woman. She's a common woman. She's the daughter of a husbandman or a cottager. She's born about 1520, and so she's raised in the bosom of a prosperous village before the economic downturn of mid-century. She's also raised in the bosom of a Roman Catholic church that's not been reformed. As a child, she spends her weekdays helping her mother with household chores, looking after animals and smaller children, of which there are many, and helping her father with harvest and planting. Food is plentiful. Her Sabbath, she spends in church, where she experiences the mysteries of the Latin Mass. She prays, as she is bidden, for the King, Queen Catherine, Princess Mary, and the Pope. But in her teenage years, the prayers change. She still prays for the King, but now she's being asked to pray for Queen Anne, and then Queen Jane, and then, oddly enough, Queen Catherine again. She prays for Princess Elizabeth, and then not, and then Prince Edward, and no one mentions Princess Mary anymore, or the Pope. Images? Come down. The Bible goes in. In subsequent years, her church will switch from Latin Mass to English prayer book. The altar will be moved to the middle, and they start calling it a table. Then it'll go back to Latin, and suddenly the images will go back up. It turns out that they were buried in the churchyard by the vicar. Then, in her 40s, she'll go back again to English, and the images that were restored under Mary will be burnt or whitewashed over. All the time, she's praying for a new monarch. She marries in the 1540s, but she's not allowed to have a reception in the churchyard as she had always planned. And yet, important as all these things are, she shrugs her shoulders at these bewilderments because what preoccupies her mind is the hardness of the times and the price of bread. Now, that wouldn't have preoccupied the historian teaching this course some 50 years ago. That is, in the old days, professional historians didn't tend to worry very much about the day-to-day lives of ordinary people. Our bailiwick was the big stuff of political and diplomatic history. Reigns, wars, treaties, laws, political scandals, the biographies of about 12 really important people, with the occasional economic trend thrown in to please the Marxists. Now, this was all perfectly natural. The events we've been describing are great and momentous. These lives have been interesting. They are the stuff of great stories. Wolsey's deathbed. Who can resist that? Who can resist Anne of Cleves' face, apart from Henry? Or Elizabeth's golden speech? For who does not love a great story? But about the middle of the last century, we historians began to realize that that story was not the whole story, that telling it was not enough. Shortly after World War II, professional historians of Britain and most other parts of the world began to realize that there were whole continents of human experience, the histories of ordinary people, their work and play, their diseases, their crimes, their religious and folk beliefs, though here anthropologists gave some hints, their culture and their art, though art historians had paid some attention, their families, their marriages, their children, their deaths, and not just the lives and deaths of men, but of that other half of the human race, all too often left out of the political story, women. To understand these histories, to recover the experience of masses of people long dead, our ancestors, historians had to learn to navigate whole new series of documents that were not themselves very new at all. Not laws or treaties, diplomatic and political correspondence, royal portraits, you know, the stuff, the fodder of the political historian. But utilitarian material, seemingly without interest in its own right, containing seemingly inconsequential details about countless lives which, when added up, began to open windows upon these people's worlds. I'm talking about parish registers recording baptisms, marriages, and deaths, poll books which record votes, wills and account books which record the material detritus of life, legal records, indictments, recognizances, depositions. Not to mention the fruits of archaeology, the material culture of human life, to be found in house architecture, tools, furniture, toys. Why this sudden interest in ordinary life? many reasons, I think, and they have more to do with our time or the time that we've lived through in the last 50 or 60 years than with their time. Perhaps to the generation of historians returning from World War II, certainly to those who grew up in the 1960s, there was a sense that there was more to life than studying or even obeying authority. In Britain, the embrace of socialism after World War II was thought to elevate the common man. It was only natural that historians would be interested in his or her history. There was the influence of the new social sciences, economics, sociology, and anthropology. And related to this was the prestige of thinkers like Karl Marx and Max Weber. Whatever one thought of their politics, all suggested that change came not solely from the decisions of a few powerful men, so much as from the people and the conditions under which they live. It is to the people of England under the Tudors and Stuarts that we will now turn for some 8 lectures. In the course of these lectures, we will learn of titanic forces shaping England and the English, which were at the same time less dramatic and immediately noticeable than the Reformation or the war with Spain, but were just as important and often far more real, more pressing in the lives of ordinary people. You didn't necessarily notice the day the prices went up, but that would begin to affect your life. We'll talk about a growing population. We'll talk about runaway inflation, the internal domestic disruptions caused by Reformation and war, so the home front side of Reformation and war. We'll talk about poor harvests and disease and the decline of the wool trade. All these things strained the economy and the social hierarchy of England. The result was a period in which the old great chain of being threatened to fall apart. During the course of these 8 lectures, we will ask some fundamental questions. What were the lives of ordinary English men and women like at the death of Queen Elizabeth in 1603? How had those lives changed since 1485? Was their world more or less disordered than before? How did they make sense of it? How did they cope with it? How was the great chain of being doing? In this lecture, we'll examine a few simple demographic and economic facts. We're going to lay the groundwork for the other lectures. We'll talk about a rising population. We'll talk about nearly a century of high inflation. And we'll go through each social rank in England to see how they did. In subsequent lectures, we'll have more time for individuals. But even as you listen to this one, bear in mind that woman. Keep her in mind and ask yourself, how is her life changing over the course of the Tudor century? Our inquiry must begin with a single fundamental fact that drove nearly all the others about the economic and social history of England at the end of the Tudor period. There were more people. Between 1525 and 1600, the population of England and Wales rose from 2.4 million to about 4.5 million souls. Between 1600 and 1660, it rose to over 5.5 million. Now, this growth was not steady. It slowed down or halted because of the following conditions. The bad harvests still happened, and they made for hard economic times. In 1527, 29, 1544, 45, 1549, 51, 1554, 56, 1586, 88, at the time of the Armada, 1594, 97, 1622, 23, the whole of the 1630s, the late 1640s, and most of the 1650s. In all these periods, food grew more scarce, and therefore prices rose. Sometimes this led to outright famine. More often, the high food prices led to the inability of the poor to buy it, and therefore poorer resistance to disease. Thus, Sir John Cheke wrote in 1549, "Experience teacheth us that after a great dearth cometh a great death, and in particular that vehemency of plague naturally followeth the dint of hunger." Indeed, plague epidemics struck repeatedly during this period. In 1546-47, 1550-52, 1554-55, 1563, 1578-79, 1582, 1584-5, 1589-93, 1597, 1603-4, which caused James I to delay his coronation, 1610, 1625, and finally, though no one knew that it was the final outbreak, the Great Plague of London in 1665. I know this means that just about the only good period in Elizabethan history was maybe 4 months in 1575. Now, I'm sure that these lists of bad years have not been the most exciting element of the course for you, but they're there to remind you that one never knew what was going to happen next, and that bad years could follow upon bad years. One rarely had a whole decade of prosperity or peace. The sweating sickness or influenza killed many between 1555 and 1560. Other diseases, including smallpox, cholera, typhus, typhoid fever, and whooping cough. Many were especially virulent among children who had no resistance. Starvation and disease actually reversed the demographic trend toward expansion. The population actually fell in the 1550s, the 1590s, and the 1620s. So we have a weird situation here where the population is growing overall, and yet there are these momentary setbacks. The combination was devastating because, on the one hand, the momentary setbacks could kill you, and when they didn't, the rising population led to ever higher inflation. Now, normally, as we've said, population expansion is a good thing for an economy. It creates more demand and supplies the labor to satisfy that demand. But the economy of early modern England wasn't flexible enough to deal with either temporary setbacks or the overall expansion. The result was a steady inflation that was made worse by Henry VIII's debasement of the coinage and Elizabeth's high war taxes. This situation created winners and losers. Landowners did well, especially those with extensive holdings. More people meant more demand for food. That's good if you're growing food. But the English food supply was inelastic. Not enough land could be cleared. Not enough fens could be drained. Efficient agricultural techniques were about 50 years away. As a result, the food supply didn't grow, and that drove the price of food higher. As I've indicated, historians also think that Henry VIII's two recoinages, 1526-27 and 1544-45, made it worse, as did Elizabeth's taxation. Another theory is that Spanish bullion from the New World was causing inflation all over Europe, as there was. It isn't just England that's going through this. It also doesn't help that England, and indeed Northern Europe, went through a period of time sometimes referred to as the Little Ice Age. Temperatures dropped by about a degree, maybe two, at the beginning of the 17th century. In any case, food prices rose 400% between 1500 and 1610. The laws of supply and demand apply to people as well. The oversupply of tenants meant that landlords could charge higher rents. Some rents increased tenfold between 1510 and 1642. The oversupply of laborers meant that employers didn't have to pay more wages, and sometimes they could pay less. All of these developments meant bigger profits for landowners, who could plow them into buying the new land, flooding the market from the dissolution of the monasteries. This enabled many nobles and gentry to expand their holdings. It's a good time to be a big landowner. It also enabled many prosperous yeomen to rise into that next rank and become gentle. But independent small farmers, unable to keep up, went into debt and often sold to larger landowners, which only added to the pool of available land for them. So everything's working in their favor. In short, as the Tudor sun set, the rich were getting richer. The opposite side of the coin is, of course, that the poor tenants and landless laborers, the vast majority of the population, were getting poorer. Now, if you've gotten out your calculator since I gave you the last statistics, you've concluded that the annual rate of inflation, if you base it on food prices and rents, was still only about 2% a year. We would be very happy with such a rate of inflation. But remember that most workers' wages had not risen since the Middle Ages, since the late Middle Ages. The demographic expansion and the associated inflation were a slow-going disaster, especially for husbandmen, whose holdings were so small that they had no surplus crops to sell. Often their income had to be supplemented by these wages that aren't rising. Cottagers who owned no land and bought all their food and depended on wages did even worse. Laborers whose wages had been fixed in the Middle Ages did worse still. Finally, the glut of tenants made it easier for landlords to throw delinquents off the land and replace them with new faces. Many people lost their leases or left their land for cities and towns where the work was still plentiful, but also growing less so because of the decline of the wool trade and because of that increasing population, which was making the towns more crowded and flooding the labor market. After 1607, for many, the only hope was to emigrate to America. The poorest traveled as indentured servants or from the mid-17th century as convicts whose death sentences had been commuted to transportation, in effect, banishment from England. Those who stayed in England became vagrants and thus outlaws. Now, obviously, these economic changes had a profound effect on every topic we'll cover in the next 8 or 10 or 12 or maybe even 15 lectures. On each of the ranks, and they also had a tremendous effect on each of the ranks in the great chain of being. Below, for the remainder of this lecture, I'm going to concentrate on life in the country. We'll deal with townspeople in Lecture 25. To refresh your memory, at the top of the great chain of being, after the king, I think we can agree that we've spent enough time for a while on kings. We'll get back to them. Was the nobility, comprising dukes, marquesses, earls, viscounts, and barons. This rank was expanding in size from about 40 families in 1485 to 60 in 1600, to 130 by the 1640s. They were also doing well economically, at least I think so. They were making thousands of pounds a year on rent and off of the sale of produce grown on their land. Some were learning to exploit their mineral rights in tin, lead, coal, etc. A very few were beginning to invest in trade. A larger number grew wealthy because they had jobs at court or they were able to use court favor to make some money. Remember those monopolies that Elizabeth granted? Well, very often she's granting them to nobles. Remember those privateering voyages? Nobles like Leicester and Walsingham are investing in them. And yet the nobility, even the nobility, was experiencing uncomfortable changes at the end of the Tudor period. Remember that the Tudors had sought to reduce their power by outlawing private armies and affinities. Remember affinities? They'd also sought to replace great magnates like the earls of Northumberland and Westmoreland at the top of the chain in localities. Increasingly, the Tudors had relied on councils or direct rule. Now, I want to be careful here. This doesn't mean that they got rid of the nobles entirely from the local chain of command. In fact, at the end of Elizabeth's reign, a new office is created, that of Lord Lieutenant. The Lord Lieutenant is a peer who's in charge of a county. His job is to make sure to maintain order, to raise the militia, to oversee tax collection. So peers are still important. Still, even the fact that they're expanding in numbers does make them less exclusive. That exclusivity would go further because James I will actually start selling noble titles in order to ease the royal debt. And so what had previously been something that was only awarded through favor or birth was now awarded through money. The sheer expense of aristocratic life seems to have ruined many. It was expected that late Tudor nobles were to live in a great state. As one contemporary wrote in 1665, "Now every one of this class prepares a full table, has good attendance, keeps horses, wears rich clothes, gives great wages, retains many servants, builds magnificently, furnishes amply, adorns luxuriantly their bodies, children, and houses, by which many costly diversions the paunch of an estate is pinched." Sounds a bit like the 1990s, doesn't it? These people built elaborate country houses at this time, like Hatfield or Theobald's. They spent half the year in London, which was very expensive. They provided hospitality to their neighbors, to their tenants, to their monarchs when they should choose to visit. I'd like to quote just one example of the extent of this hospitality. It is an extreme example, but I think you'll get the point. It's the list of what was consumed over the 3-day wedding of Lord Burleigh's daughter at the late 16th century. The crowd, the guests, ate 6 veals, 26 deer, 15 pigs, 14 sheep, 16 lambs, 4 kids, that's goats, not children, 6 hares, 36 swans, 2 storks, 41 turkeys, over 370 poultry, 49 curlews, 135 mallards, 354 teals, 1,049 plovers, 280 stints, 109 pheasants, 277 partridges, 615 cocks, 485 snipe, 840 larks, 21 gulls, 71 rabbits, 23 pigeons, and 2 sturgeon. Well, they got their protein anyway. All of this was washed down with 1,000 gallons of wine at a total cost of £629. Now, in the 1960s, the historian Lawrence Stone looks at this and looks at the expense of aristocratic life and the fact that the Tudors are diminishing their power and thinks that he sees a crisis of the aristocracy, that lots of aristocrats are going bankrupt, they're not as important as they used to be. Most historians don't agree with that idea, but you can see that there are drawbacks, that there is this conspicuous consumption that one has to engage in. Many people would argue that it isn't so much that the aristocracy was falling, but that the gentry was rising. In fact, it was Stone's own academic supervisor, R.H. Taney, who first proposed in the 1940s this very idea of the rise of the gentry. There are two problems with it. First, the term gentleman was never very precise, and it was being redefined in our period. This was partly because of all those new men who were moving in and buying the monastic lands. Partly because James I was also selling gentle ranks as well. He created a new rank, that of baronet above a knight, and then he sold it, which meant, again, that gentle status, which heretofore had been associated with birth and land, is now associated with money. Partly because contemporaries were beginning to see the value of education and professional activity, they also began to associate that with gentle, with being gentle. And so you have a situation in which it's not very clear who is a gentleman and who isn't. According to William Harrison, anyone that can live idly and without manual labor and thereto is able and will bear the port, charge, and countenance of a gentleman shall be reputed for a gentleman. Which boils down to, if it walks like a duck, it must be a duck. The second problem with saying the gentry rose is that they didn't all do so. Gentry fortunes varied from family to family. And yet, overall, I accept Taney's position. The number of gentry was increasing. For example, the availability of monastic lands swelled their ranks from about 6,500 in 1540 to perhaps 20,000 in 1640, or about now 2% of the population. This 2% now owned one-third to one-half of the land in England. The greater gentry now had multiple estates, rivaling the peerage in wealth, making anywhere from £500 to even several thousand pounds a year. The lesser or parish gentry, the ones with just one small estate, might still struggle to make £100. So you have a sense of the ruling class beginning to split in England. The Tudors made the gentry more important because they made JPs more important. They gave justices of the peace more responsibility for looking out for their localities, responsibility that 100 years earlier might have been given to a nobleman. So here's another reason for believing that the gentry were rising. At the center, the House of Commons, dominated by the gentry, was also becoming the more important of the two houses of Parliament. For all these reasons, I think we can agree that real change in this society is associated with the gentry. Just below them came yeomen. This is the group that contemporary commentators like the best. They think of the yeomen as being the backbone of England. They are, to early modern England, the equivalent of the American middle class, which of course means that they're always under tremendous pressure, economic, social, cultural. Yeomen were substantial farmers. There were maybe 90,000 families of them in 1600. They owned or leased as freeholders maybe 50 acres of land. Though less than 10% of the population, their share of the land is rising to 25% in 1600. By the way, if you do the math, 50% for the gentry, 25% for the yeomanry, maybe 10% for the nobility, doesn't leave very much for either the king or the poor. Yeomen lived nice lives. They slept on feather beds. They ate wheaten bread. They sent their sons to grammar schools. They could vote for their parliamentary representatives because they were worth much more than the 40 shillings, £2 a year, that was the requirement dating back from the Middle Ages. So here, inflation did some good. It brought more people into the ranks of voters. But during this period, the yeomen split. A substantial, successful yeoman with food to sell, crops to sell, was able to take advantage of the inflation and maybe buy his way into the gentry by purchasing some monastic lands. But a poorer yeoman, whose holdings were small or poor or relatively barren, was never able to make much more than maybe £200 a year. That wasn't enough to get them into the ranks of the gentry, and over time, they lost ground. Increasingly, yeomen at this level, lesser yeomen, fell back into the ranks of husbandmen and cottagers. These people suffered the most from the poor, or more than their betters, from the poor economic conditions. Husbandmen, to remind you, are small farmers. They hold about 30 acres of land. They live in small farmhouses. They're multi-roomed now, We'll talk about that in a later lecture. They might have one servant to assist them. They made perhaps 30 to 45 pounds a year. Therefore, they too have a vote. Cottagers, according to a statute of 1589, are all supposed to have 4 acres of land. But in fact, it almost never happens. The typical cottager just has a cottage, which, remember, he's renting. He doesn't own. He has no substantial lands of his own. He has no surplus of food to sell. He has no servants to help him. He makes only a few pounds in a good year. Now, to give you a kind of base, it requires about 12 pounds a year to support a small family. So these people, cottagers and even husbandmen, would have had to find supplemental work. The men might work for the landlord on his land, and the work on their own land would be in their spare time. Women would shear sheep, they would spin, they would weave wool cloth. Many went into debt to purchase crops or fell behind on their rents. During the 1590s, 1620s, and 1650s in particular, some from this group were thrown off their land when unable to pay. You know, when we think of the early modern village, I think we tend to think of a place that's placid and unchanging, in keeping with the great chain of being. And that had been true at the end of the Middle Ages, perhaps. But the demographic and economic changes that we've been talking about today made nonsense of that expectation of village life. According to parish registers, one half to two thirds of any given English village was no longer there 10 years later. That is to say, these people are being forced to pick up and move. Maybe they're losing their lands, unable to pay their rents. Maybe they're losing their ability to make extra money through working on the Lord's land. Maybe they just haven't shorn enough sheep or woven enough wool cloth. They're on the road. The very poor, made up of these husbandmen and cottagers who'd lost their land, along with demobilized soldiers, remember Elizabeth's wars, will be addressed in greater detail in Lecture 24. Perhaps the most important thing to note here is the hardness of the times, which seemed to produce more of them. They moved about looking for work or charity. Others were often afraid of them. Maybe it's time, after this blizzard of statistics, to go back to our woman. Just as she marries, and again in her mid-30s, the harvest fails, the first time delaying her wedding because her betrothed can't support her. Over the course of her life, grain grows more dear, and her landlord raises the rents. She doesn't like to think about it, but the pains in her belly from not being able to eat might explain why that last pregnancy didn't quite turn out. She has 6, 7 children. 1, 2, perhaps 3 die in the course of these various epidemics. The last one, perhaps, in the 1558 influenza. As the bells are ringing to proclaim Queen Elizabeth, she might be thinking of a lost child. She tries to help her husband by shearing and spinning wool, but the factor who comes round to buy the wool comes round less and less. In 1588, she sees her sons called into the militia. Fortunately, they see no action. But in the 1590s, hunger and old age carry off her husband. She knows that she was lucky to have him for so long, and indeed to have lived so long herself. But from now on, she must rely on the poor law. What's going to happen to her? What's going to happen to her children? In the course of the next few lectures, I'd like you to remember her. I'd like you to ask that question. In this lecture, we've begun our examination of life in early modern England by talking about broad economic and demographic trends. Basically, as the Tudors gave way to the Stuarts, England had more mouths to feed than it knew how. The rich were getting richer and the poor poorer. The gentry and upper yeomanry were growing in wealth and power. The aristocracy was holding its own. Everybody else was struggling. These developments alone would have been enough to put strain on the great chain of being. Some historians would argue that the economic distance between the rich and the poor was also manifested in a cultural difference, that the lives of poor people and the lives of their betters were growing so very different that there's a sort of cultural disjunction whereby each side can't understand the other. To try to understand whether that was true, we're now going to turn to the issue of people's private lives. In recent years, historians have grown more interested in private lives. As in political history, that subject has created its own set of controversies. How big were families? Did parents love their children? Did they rear them more harshly than we do today? Did they arrange their children's marriages? Could young people marry for love? Did men oppress women? Were people more religious than we are today? Harder working? Less materialistic? How did they deal with their own mortality? As with other questions to be posed in this segment of the course, the answers often varied by social rank. Even if we examine families by rank, it's also clear that families differed one to another. In the next lecture, we'll begin at the top with the private lives of the landed aristocracy.